Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening, and thanks for being with us. Thank you, one and all, for taking the time out of your busy day to spend a little time with us and listen to our wonderful guests. My guest tonight is Catherine Mayfield, who's been on before, and she has a new book about bullying, and we will be talking to her about that in a few minutes. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing. And there's a story I want to tell you, but there's a preamble to the story. We live in a culture where getting upset about things and freaking out basically has a life of its own. We even have initials for it now, OMG. And then people write about things that they don't know much about, except for maybe they went to Wikipedia and read one article and who knows who wrote it. So what's our fascination with freaking out? Well, it makes you feel alive. It gives you a lot of energy. You get to feel like there's something important going on. And we do this about all kinds of things, including our health. So, you know, there are classically New York Jewish jokes about how any little tiny thing can turn out in your mind to be a major disastrous disease. And I grew up in that culture, which is why it amuses me. But when you think about it, doctors talk about the placebo effect. So if you believe that you're going to get better, if you believe that the treatment is working, your body will react to it as if it's going to get better, and it will get better. So you can give people a placebo, which means it's a pill or a treatment that really has no known medical effect. And if you convince them that it will have an effect, in most cases, the person will get better. And that's a wonderful thing, and it drives doctors crazy, and they don't quite know what to make of it, because they think that physical interventions is what's going to heal things. So they really don't get this whole idea of the mind having an effect. What doesn't get talked about that much is the evil twin of the placebo effect, which is the nocebo effect, which is a real word. And there's research on it, except you can't do research where you're going to make people sick. So there isn't a lot of research on it. But if you tell people that they're going to get sick, for example, list a lot of side effects and say that it's likely that they will get them, the people will get them. And if you tell them that they're going to die, in most cases, people will accept that death sentence and cooperate with you and even die at the exact time that you told them to. You know, oh, you're going to live another 3 months. And so in 3 months, they die because they've accepted that and their body accommodates to it and makes it real. So all of that is a constant fascination for me. And I'm always reading about things and putting little pieces into that puzzle. But there's an experience that I had, 15 years ago or so now, that was a turning point in my life. And it really is an element of this. I don't know if you've experienced shingles or been around anybody that's had shingles, but it's like poison ivy with nerve pain. It is really an obnoxious thing to get. And it's, you know, a virus that's in your body all the time. And some people get this physical manifestation of a rash. And there's really nothing that they can do about it except have you wait it out. And it takes several months for it to go away. And most people get it on their back or on their side. But a few lucky people, like me, will get it on their head and face. It follows a nerve because it's an infection of the nerve, and it will go along that nerve, and there's one that goes up across your head and down around your eye. I can't even express to you how scary and painful and bizarre it is. And because it was around my eye, they put me on antiviral medications, and I was on pain medications, which always just put me to sleep. So I was sleeping probably 18 or 20 hours a day, and in the 4 hours or so that I was awake and functional, I was working because I was a freelancer and I had deadlines. So I had a lot of reason to complain. It was exceedingly unpleasant. And then there was a moment when I took a look at my situation and realized that this was not going to kill me. When it was over, it was not going to leave much behind, other than maybe a few scars from the lesions. I was going to be fine. I just had to wait and do the right things and wait until it was done. And when it was done, life would go on. So I can do that. Not a big deal. And I can do that without complaining. And I find that my life changed completely with that realization that there are just some things in life that are painful or incredibly obnoxious or frustrating or whatever the situation is. And in most cases, almost all cases, it's not going to kill you. It's not going to leave much of a problem behind when it's over, unless you make it a problem. And in all likelihood, it'll be a good story about how you overcame this adversity. But it doesn't get any better from whining about it. It doesn't get better from complaining about it. You don't get to use your energy in the little bit of time that you feel okay in this situation effectively if what you use your energy for is telling people a story and whining about it. And I can't tell you what a powerful moment that was. Well, I can. I just did. But it's difficult to express what a powerful turning point it is when you realize that whining doesn't help and most things are not the problem that you're making it into. The problem is that you're whining. And I would suggest that you consider many of the things that are in quotation marks, you have to imagine me doing air quotes, big problems in your life or in the world, and consider what it would be like not to focus on your feelings about it and projecting it into the future and what would happen if this goes on forever and oh my God, all the things that we do. And instead say, this too shall pass. This will run its course. At the end of it, things will be different. But in all likelihood, I'll still be here. I'll be fine. All the people that love me will still love me. We will go through this together. It's all going to be okay. And so that's what was up this morning. So I'm glad I could tell the story tonight. And that's tonight's metaphysical musing. And now let's introduce Catherine Mayfield, my wonderful guest, who is actually a local friend and somebody that I've met and we've done some things together. Hi, Catherine. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Thank you, David. How
Good.
Are you?
I'm great. And I'm excited about your new book and about the topic of the book. It's called Bullied, Why You Feel Bad Inside and What You Can Do About It. And it's targeted at teens who have been bullied. So we're going to talk about that, but I'm going to start the way we always start and say, who are you, Catherine? And how did you wind up here writing this book?
Are you sure you want to know?
Actually, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, good. Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be on the show. And I'm really excited about this book, which is coming out August 12th. And the way I got here was I grew up in a very dysfunctional family, as many, many, many people did. Had a lot of difficulties. There was emotional abuse. I was bullied in school. In fact, I was called Four Eyes and Metal Mouth because I had glasses and braces. And I was also called Worm, which was short for bookworm, because I loved to read. So I grew up
You had the nerd trifecta.
Yeah, that's right. I still wear glasses, but everything else is okay. But I grew up with all this sort of pain and uncertainty inside, and I felt really inferior to other people because of all the things that had happened. And when I was in my 30s, I was getting a divorce, and I saw a therapist for a while. And I began to understand that there are tools that we can use to deal with all that, you know, OMG stuff that goes on inside. They're emotional intelligence tools. And over the next 20 years, which probably gives you a good idea of about how old I am, but I don't care, I started using these tools and sort of getting to a much better place in my life by dealing with all the stuff that was going on inside. And last year, I published a memoir called The Box of Daughter, which was about growing up in my dysfunctional family and my recovery from all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And when I finished that book, I would go around to libraries and do signings at bookstores, and everyone kept saying, "It's like you wrote my life story. You know, yeah. I could relate so much to all this stuff." And I had one teenager, actually, who came up and was very quiet and said, "I didn't know this happened to anybody else."
Right.
And that's when I got the idea for this book, for the book for teens who have been bullied. And it's actually written also for adults who are trying to recover from things that happened years and years ago. And I really liked what you said about the freaking out and the OMG. Because I've discovered that the more I complain, the more bad stuff happens. It's like I'm creating mm-hmm. my own reality.
Well, it's a basic principle of metaphysics that what you focus on gets more energy, and what you focus on will tend to be attracted to you.
Yeah, yeah, right. And I grew up with what I like to call the drama addiction. Mm-hmm. You know, where my family was we didn't explore much of life. We didn't try to do much in terms of, you know, expanding ourselves or the community or whatever. We got really upset when we spilled the milk or when our shoes got muddy, you know. And to me, that's like a drama addiction. And yep. what I've been trying to do in my recovery is to sort of move that energy over into the projects and what I want to accomplish in my life so that my life gets really big and my life becomes dramatic in a good way. You know, because I'm you know, being successful at some things and doing what I want to do. And then just let the little stuff, you know, the spilled milk and the muddy shoes, just kind of fall by the wayside and say, I'm not going to remember that in 2 weeks.
Right, right. You know, the old expression is, will this matter in 5 years? But for most things, it's, will it matter tomorrow?
Yeah.
Will it matter this weekend? And people are just, as you say, addicted to the emotional charge. You know, they get a, as we would say in the old neighborhood, a zets, a little charge of emotional energy. And it's another way to get high. It's not a good way to get high.
That's true.
And it also, there's a lot of evidence that emotional angst suppresses your immune system and causes you to feel worse and possibly get sick. So it becomes a vicious cycle.
Yes, that's true. And I think what happens sometimes when kids are bullied is that emotional stuff just grows and grows. And that's the energy that the bully feeds on. You know, when a kid is bullying another kid, they're looking for a huge response. You know,
right.
They're looking for that big emotional response. And one of the things I say in the book is that if kids can learn, you know, they may have the emotions anyway, probably going to, you know, but if they can learn to just, you know, act cool, like it doesn't bother them, then the bully doesn't get a charge from it, you know, and they'll go and do something else. And it takes a little practice, in my experience, to be able right. to do that. But I think it's very helpful when you're having to deal with a bully.
Yeah, I was thinking of it, it's because we're talking about the book, I was thinking about bullies, and bullies usually have extremely low self-esteem, even though they look like they're full of themselves.
Yes.
And they're vampires. They're just looking to suck energy from other people because they feel so badly about themselves.
Yes. You're right.
And I think we can see that at this point, especially in politics, but in a number of other areas where there are people doing all kinds of bizarre and dastardly things to large groups of people, mostly because they've got so little themselves. They think so little of themselves that somebody has to be beneath them.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. They think so little of themselves that they're trying to put somebody else down to make them smaller than what they feel is their small self.
Right. Yeah, there's an expression that I will not complete that goes, at least I'm not a, and you can insert whatever the repressed, suppressed group is that you want to put in there that people are trying to keep down. There are a lot of people who get their self-esteem from being one up from people that are they consider to be very low, much lower than they are.
Oh yes, that's really exactly I think what my parents did to me. I think they had very low self-esteem themselves, and they were great people. They did a lot of wonderful stuff in the community. They volunteered. They would help anybody. You know, but when it got home behind the closed doors, they had to criticize and belittle their kids so they could feel like they were bigger. It's insidious, I think.
Having grown up in, it wasn't my parents, but the grandparents and the extended family that did that kind of stuff in my family. And there's an element to it where they think they're doing the right thing, that it's going to be a positive motivating factor. Yeah, I have to do something, because if I don't, things are just going to be wild and crazy. So I have to control this crazy thing that could happen that I'm not seeing in front of me by putting all these things in place to keep it from happening. And it's just their fear and their attempt to do something with absolutely no skills.
Yeah. I think it's the way, for my parents, it's the way they were brought up. It's all they knew.
Yeah. Yeah, and it didn't work very well for them, but it got programmed in as the way you do parenting.
Yeah.
And of course, the problem is that for little kids, especially very little kids, parents are God. Mm-hmm. They created you. They tell you what everything is called. They tell you, show you how to do everything. They tell you who to be and how to be it. They're God. They define your universe.
Yeah.
So the level of power that the words of a parent have, especially emotional words, is, extraordinary. And most people never think of that. They're just acting out their own pain.
That's true. You're right.
You know, it takes an exceptional parent to go, this isn't about me. This isn't about how I feel. This is about my kid and how they feel and how they're going to go through their life. And there aren't that many people that think that way.
No, you're right. And I think what it really takes is that the parent has to have been able at some point in their lives to have dealt with a lot of their own issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're able to be clear of their own issues when they're, you know, interacting with the child. Otherwise, all that old stuff just comes right out.
Right. And it comes out as what your parents said, you know. You open your mouth and it's your mother.
Uh-huh. That still happens to me. Yeah, like, my parents dance around in my head and have arguments and, you know, still tell me what to do. And sometimes I just say, I'm not doing that. I have to disobey.
Hey, you guys, go to your room.
Yeah, really.
Family dynamics and how it affects us and how long it affects us is really, really fascinating. You did some interesting things in your prior career, which I assume were well informed by living in a family full of drama. You were an actor.
Yes. Yes, that's actually how I learned about emotions. That was part of my sort of emotional intelligence training, because we weren't allowed to express emotions when I was growing up. Only my parents could have them. And usually they were angry and being upset, you know.
Right.
So I didn't learn very much about emotion, but as an actor, it was an incredible experience, because I could explore, you know, every facet of every emotion and see what it felt like. Even though I was playing a character, I would still, you know, be exploring the emotion.
Right.
I could explore different kinds of people. I could feel kind of what different kinds of lives felt like, you know, because our family was just, we were very insular is the only word I can think of. We didn't get out much. We didn't explore much. We just kind of took the same steps every day in the same community and did kind of the same kinds of things. So acting was a really wonderful opportunity to find out who I am. It really helped me learn who I am and connect with other people as well.
I've actually heard that from other actors and acting teachers, you know, who have asked me, so what do you do with all those other parts of yourself that you don't get to to give a voice to? So it's not something that I've ever been involved with, but I think I have a little bit of a sense of it. And for you, that must have been a major breakthrough.
Yes, it was. It was very definitely. It kind of helped me find myself. And I think the same thing can absolutely be done without being an actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if one is sort of open to, you know, this strange thought that comes out when you wake up in the morning, gee, I'd like to go, you know, stand on my head in the park and see what happens or whatever. You know, there's some part of the self that's wanting to be expressed, however that comes out. So one of the big parts of my recovery from the past has been sort of letting all these parts of myself express themselves. And, you know, I don't do anything really crazy or dangerous, you know, but there's a lot of room in there to find out who you are if you just sort of listen to those little intuitions that society and our parents told us, no, that's not right.
Right.
But the intuitions are there for a reason.
Yeah, it's we live in a society that on the one hand wants us to be creative and on the other hand is afraid of creativity. So it's
that's a good point.
So let's give people information on how to find you and information about the book. What's your website?
It's www.katherine-mayfield.com. It's KATHERINE-MAYFIELD. And then for my other book, it's theboxofdaughter.com.
Terrific. And we'll talk about whether you have other projects going on and what else is going on with the book, but we're going to be going to a break in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
I noticed on the website you have for the book that you're taking donations for a project. What's that project?
It's with a fundraising site called usaprojects.org.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crowdfunding site. And the project is, what I'm hoping to do is raise enough money to print at least 500 books and distribute them to school systems all across the country. You know, to send a book to like a lot of school districts across the country, particularly in Colorado and Connecticut and some in New York and places where they've had a lot of difficulty. Because I really feel like this book, there's a section in it for bullies, actually, which talks about, you know, when you're so angry and you want to lash out at someone, what do you do? So I really feel like this book would be helpful in stopping some of the bullying and preventing some of the teenagers from taking their lives after they're bullied. I feel so sad when I hear that another teen committed suicide.
Right.
So this USA project is up there to raise funds to print as many books as possible and distribute them to school districts across the country.
That's great.
I want to help. There are so many kids in so much pain. I just want to help.
Right. And how do you get the books to the right kids? That's a wonderful idea. Well, we will be back in just a few minutes with Katherine Mayfield talking more about her book, Bullied. And I want to hear more detail about what you did in the book. So don't go nowhere. We'll be right back with the Farkas Files.
This week's episode, Fire at the Shed.
Gee, Johnny, this rope swing sure is swell.
Don't I know it.
Hey, it's Sassy.
I think she's trying to tell us something. Mr. Gunderson? What about Mr. Gunderson?
A fire? Mr. Gunderson's trapped?
Where, Sassy? Where?
What, Sassy? Now that you've got our attention, you'd like to take a moment to talk about shelter pets? Shelter pets in general are well-adjusted, healthy, and love being with people?
Sassy, we don't have time!
Pets often end up in shelters due to owner problems like divorce or allergies?
That's great, Sassy, but what about the fire?
There is no fire! You're just messing with our heads?
Sassy!
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude! What happened to your face? I see one, two,
ow,
three, four, five, six.
Ow.
Dude, what is
ow
this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it?
Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called inventnow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on and lost cats stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See? That's proof. You should go to the inventnow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at inventnow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with Catherine Mayfield, author of the book Bullied. And I'd love to hear more about what you did in the book. You know, it's got sections for kids that are being bullied and sections for bullies, but tell me more about the recovery method that you talk about in the book.
Okay. It's a very simple formula. It's not actually easy to put into practice, but it's a pretty simple formula. And it basically consists of figuring out what feeling you're having, because sometimes we aren't really sure. We just feel very emotional, and we're not sure if it's sadness or anger, frustration, and sometimes it's a mix. But mm-hmm. it's important to sort of acknowledge, okay, that's what I'm feeling. You know, rather than pushing it away and say, I'm not going to deal with this emotional stuff, because it never really goes away. It always comes back to haunt you somehow.
Right.
So the first step is just to say, this is what I'm feeling. And then to find a way that's comfortable, and I suggest people usually do this in private unless they have a very good friend they're comfortable with, but find a way to let go of the emotion. And some good examples are, for instance, going to a sad movie with a box of Kleenex and just crying a lot. I actually, when I was angry, I used to have this red plastic baseball bat inflatable, you know, that you could blow up a large bat from one of the baseball teams. And I would whack it on the bed, you know, when I got really angry. And it feels good to let the emotion out, but I think more importantly, it sort of gets it out of the system. Because I've read, and I'm pretty sure that emotions that are repressed get stuck in the muscles, in the body, and the tendons. They're sort of recorded there if they're not able to be expressed at the time the emotion comes up. So it's good to use the body somehow, dancing, or one of my favorites is going over and opening a window and going and just kind of letting it all, and I can feel the emotional energy kind of move out.
Right.
So that's the next step, is letting go of it. And then, because it's very important to sort of get reoriented so you don't get stuck in the emotion, to make go out to lunch with friends or pet your animals or do something you really enjoy. So you can remind yourself, you know, that there are good things in life. Right. And I think what happens with bullies and victims of bullies is that they never get to express these emotions. You know, when a kid is bullied on the playground, they can't just sit down and bawl. It just doesn't, you know, it's going to make things worse.
Right.
So everything kind of gets stuffed down inside and stuffed down, and it's like a bag of garbage. You can only stuff so much in it before it wants to explode, or it breaks, or, you know, stuff spills out. So that's right. That's the basic premise, the sort of basic thrust of the process in the book.
So in many ways, it's an emotional intelligence process. It's helping people that have all these suppressed emotions to understand what's going on and express them and move on from it.
Yeah. And I suggest a number of different ways for each emotion. Art is really good. I did finger paintings for many years, and you can pick your colors. You know, you can pick sad colors. You can pick mad colors, whatever, and just, you know, do. And I suggest writing. There are other things that I suggest for each of the emotions. And there's a section for kids on, if you're thinking about suicide, some things to do, some ideas. And the sort of secondary goal of the book is to help teens learn how to build self-esteem and how to feel better about themselves, because our society doesn't really teach us how to do that.
And right.
I wish it did. I wish there was, you know, a self-esteem class in every school. But there are suggestions for that. And throughout the book, there are quotes from famous people about emotions, because we tend to forget that people have been having emotions for centuries. And actually, I think they talked about them more centuries ago. You know, people were more willing to admit their humanity, I think, than people are now. We're all supposed to be perfect and perfectly successful in every way. And then
yes.
At the end of the book, there are a number of interviews with people who have been bullied in childhood and have begun to recover as adults, so that kids can see that, yes, there is a time when this is going to stop and you're going to go to college or you're going to have a job and it's all going to be behind you.
Right, right. And, you know, part of, I think, what's the hardest in all of this is the sense of helplessness and hopelessness.
Yeah.
Which doesn't have an end point, which is the nature of those emotions. It's not, I feel this way now. It's, I feel this way now. I felt this way before. I'm going to feel this way forever.
Yes. And then it sort of becomes a part of identity.
Right.
It becomes who a person is, but it isn't really, because the reason all those feelings are there is because of the experience of being bullied. It doesn't mean that's who the person is.
Right. Right.
The point of the process. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, it's a reaction. I don't know whether it's technically a form of PTSD, but it sure has some of the common threads for PTSD.
Yes. Yes, it does. So the point of it all is, I think, that when you can get rid of enough of this emotion, then you're digging down to what's really you and what you really want to do with your life and what you're really drawn to and what you're good at, you know, so that you can begin to stop being helpless and start to achieve things, start to go after goals. But I don't think you can do that by, I don't think one can do that by pushing all the emotions aside. I think they kind of have to be waded through and dealt with in order to get down to that authentic self.
Right, right. And I think the complexity of it in many ways is it's helpful to have somebody that loves you to do it with and who's telling you how wonderful you are, but it's hard to find that person when you're telling yourself how terrible you are because everybody's confirming that you must be a terrible person because all these things are happening.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And one of the things I say throughout the book is ask for help and keep asking for help and ask another person, ask somebody else until you find somebody that will help. And I couldn't have done all of this without therapy. I really, you know, a lot of people put therapy down, but there are some really, really great therapists out there who are so very helpful. And I couldn't have done it without that because my family would never have listened to any of this stuff, you know. They would have said, you're just complaining, you know. Well, why don't you just do what we say and you'll be fine.
Right, right.
Which is how I got into the whole problem in the first place.
Yeah, I think in my crazy family constellation, my dad kind of stood aloof from it and was able to debunk it when necessary. Mm-hmm. And he trained me to do that as well. My grandmother was profoundly codependent and controlling and did it by her illnesses and whining and all kinds of other stuff. So people had to help her. And people were always startled by, you know, this when I was 12 years old, coming in and just going, oh, this is what's going on? Why didn't you do that? You know, a room full of adults who were totally under her spell and unable to come up with a solution. And, you know, I'm not tall now, but I was very short then. You know, this little kid walks in and goes, well, why didn't you do this?
That's great.
and they'd all kind of stand there shaking with, oh, what? There's a solution. But most families don't have that. That gets suppressed because it changes the power dynamics.
Yes.
And, you know, I've got to be in charge even though I'm completely wrong. So if you're saying something that challenges that, I will have to suppress that. Again, very much like politics.
Yep, that's true. That's true. And the truth does come out sometimes, and people get beat over the head for telling the truth. It's terrible.
Right, right. You know, I'm becoming more and more convinced that if you want to understand codependence, just watch politics.
I kind of agree. Yeah, I'm not a very political person, and I don't watch them very often, but that makes sense to me.
You know, it's someone said, if you want the job of president, you shouldn't be allowed to have it. makes you immediately suspect.
That's true.
And I think that's true for a lot of other things. Not that there are not people who are truly in public service because they want to be of service, but I think they're salt and peppered around. It's not most of the people that go in because they want power and control.
That's probably true.
And I
think it happens in companies too, corporations. Mm-hmm. There's often that kind of dysfunctional hierarchy of power.
That's because the sociopaths go to the top and the bottom.
I never figured out how that happened. You would think it would, somebody would ferret them out and go, boy, we better not promote that person. Look how dysfunctional they are.
They're charming and they get results.
I guess that's true.
So
yeah, that's a good point.
You know, and so you have them at the top in politics and corporations, and you have them in the so-called bottom in crime, because they don't really have an emotional attachment to the outcome of what they did. They just want to get what they want.
Mm.
And that's not really different from the people at the top. It's just they happen to choose a part of life that is different. But, you know, part of it also is, and we're kind of going off bullying, but maybe not because they're all bullies, is that the power involved in controlling people is very seductive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very addictive. So I would think that bullies who feel so badly about themselves, just for the moment that they can be bullies and have a group of other bullies with them agreeing about who they should beat up or whatever it is, for a minute they feel better about themselves.
Uh-huh.
And if they can't, if they don't let themselves take in what they're doing, or they're incapable of doing it if they're a sociopath. But, you know, for most of them, I feel better for the moment, so I'm not going to look at the rest of this. I'm the king of the hill for the moment. I'm the one that's better than this kid that I'm making fun of, and everybody in my group likes me, and who cares about everybody else?
Uh-huh. Yep, I think you're right. And probably a lot of them learn that by example.
Right.
From their families or from politics or whatever.
Right. And if it happens to be a family where physical force is used to control people, then they will go out into the world and use physical force and intimidation to control other people.
Yep, because that's all they know.
Right. Right. And that, you know, it's the cowboy thing. You know, macho, I'm just a man of action kind of stuff. And that has a light side and a side and a dark side. And the light side of that is superheroes.
And well, that's true. Yeah.
And the dark side of it is the villains in those superhero scenarios. But it's also the sociopaths in corporations and politics and crime and all the rest of it who just get off on controlling people and having power and don't care.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And I think
incapable of caring.
Yeah, yeah, sometimes incapable. I guess if children aren't taught any kind of empathy or they don't see any kind of empathy, you know, there's no reason they would know it's there at all.
Yep.
But what I think is interesting, particularly in cyberbullying, and I think this happens in corporations as well, is that normal people who have normal feelings and are generally very compassionate will suddenly jump to the bully's side and be against the person who's being bullied just because they don't want to be a victim themselves.
Interesting.
You know, like lots of times, sometimes somebody will be really strong and will stand up for the victim and say, hey, you can't do that, or that's not right, or whatever. But I think 90% of the people who see a bully bullying somebody get scared themselves. You know, I don't want that to happen to me, so I'm going to have to, you know, side with the bully. That's the safe thing to do. So particularly with cyberbullying, it gets huge. And then, of course, right. People can jump in from, you know, other people from different countries and wherever, you know, to blast their own anger off on the page about this person. And it becomes so horrific.
Right. And it's incredibly cowardly. Cyberbullying is, you know, people sitting at home in their underwear, absolutely safe.
Yes.
Who usually don't know the person at all. They just have an opinion. Who then do all kinds of things that have emotional consequences with no consequence to them. Nobody knows who they are. Nobody sees them. Mm-hmm. They'll never see the consequences in most cases.
That's true.
They're just getting to be what, you know, the bad side of badass because there's no consequence to them, which to me is, you know, completely cowardly.
Cowardly. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
And most bullies are cowards as well. If anybody who really has any power stands up to them, they back right down.
Well, it's interesting to me that the way our school systems and our government are trying to stop bullies is by doing to them the same things that they're doing to their victims. They're saying, you stop right now. You have to do this. You have to do something this way, you know, or else.
Right.
That implied threat. You know, so really the bullies are getting validation for what they're doing because somebody's doing it to them.
Right. Well, you know, if you look at the average school, with few exceptions, the administrators, possibly not intentionally, but they act like bullies.
Well, that's true.
Here's the rules. We're enforcing the rules. No, I don't care what you think, and I don't care what you, how you feel about it. The rules are the rules.
You're right. Again, it's the being in that position of power.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it would be so much more effective to have some kind of forum, you know, where bullies and victims could get together and just, you know, not that it would be a cry fest or a group therapy thing or anything like that, but just some place to allow them to express, you know, the anger and the shame and the sadness, you know, so that.
But that's, you know, but that's a skill, and it takes a lot of courage, especially
right.
especially for males.
You're right. You know, that's true.
I'm thinking of a moment in high school, and I went to a high school in New York City that you had to take an entrance exam for. And at the time it was all boys, and it was 6,000 boys in one building.
Wow.
So 6,000 really, really smart boys, both being very involved in learning stuff, but also getting in all kinds of trouble. And, and it was Brooklyn after all, so we all had attitude. And my best friend stood up to one of the administrators and was threatened with all kinds of terrible things. And he just looked at the administrator and said, "You don't scare me. You don't know my dad." I need to do what I told you I need to do, and it's going to happen. And he walked out of the office and he got on the payphone and he called his father. And within 5 minutes, there was an announcement saying that he had to go to the office, and he was told that he had to go home because of whatever it was that he originally had said. And he just looked at him and said, "I guess Dad called you."
Oh, wow. That's power.
Right. You know, it's like, okay, so you've got your badass attitude and you think this is going on, but you don't know my dad.
Uh-huh.
And since I've been raised by my dad, you don't scare me at all.
Wow, that's cool that he had enough strength and self-confidence to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And we've been best friends for 50 years, and he hasn't changed much.
So. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. And it's in places where attitude is acknowledged and honored, you know, as part of the culture, like Brooklyn, most of New York, and a number of other places, you kind of realize that that's a way of expressing self-esteem and personal power, and you try and figure out what the line is. But, you know, being able to put that out there and have people go, "Oh, what should I do with this?"
Uh-huh.
You know, am I willing to find out where the edge of this is and how much of it is true and how much is bravado? That's an incredible skill and way of being in the world, which only exists in certain cultures.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
Especially as a positive aspect rather than a negative aspect. I think it probably the negative pole of it would be gangs and other groups where it's all bravado backed up with automatic weapons.
Right. Well, one of the things that has been most difficult for me to learn in my recovery from growing up amidst all this is how to set boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to be able to say to someone, "No, I'm not going to take that." You know,
right.
and for me, it's I don't have huge situations like your friend did. You know, but there are people who will definitely run right over any boundaries that anybody sets. And I grew up being a doormat because my mother was a steamroller, and she
right.
just did not let me set any boundaries at all. Nothing, not anything. You know, so it's taken me a long time to really learn that I can say no to people when I feel threatened or, you know, when it's really you know, rushing over me in some way, I can say no. And I think that's something that kids are really fuzzy about. I think that's right. Something that it would be helpful to learn.
Or when you just don't feel like doing what the person is trying to get you to do.
Yeah.
It can be very
simple. Which happens a lot when you have people who are very needy, because they need one thing today and you do that, and then they need another thing tomorrow and you do that, and by the next day they need another thing and you're so tired you say no, and they go, oh, come on, you did those other things for me, you know?
Right. And that was a mistake.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, the expression in Brooklyn is, you talking to me?
Mm.
You know, it's like, what?
Uh-huh.
You said what to who? Do you want to reconsider this?
Uh-huh. Well, that's, yeah, one of the things I mentioned in the book is that if somebody, you know, if somebody is bullying you and says, you know, an off-color remark or puts you down or something, you can say, excuse me? You know, and you're not threatening them, you're not fighting them back, but you're letting them know that you heard that they're pushing the envelope.
Right.
You know, and sometimes a bully will kind of back down and say, oh, well, you know, I was kidding or whatever. Sometimes they won't, but, you know, it's a good, for any kind of emotional or mental abuse, it's kind of a good statement because it helps you hold your ground when you just say, excuse me?
Right.
And yeah, like you said, what was the statement from Brooklyn again? You talking to me?
You talking to me?
I like
or
that.
What you looking at? There's another one. Although my dad taught me how to do what you're looking at with a glance at somebody, being able to look somebody in the eye, and in that moment, in that fraction of a second, say, you don't want to go there, and you don't want to find out why. Mm. You don't have to have anything that you could do. You just have to convince them that you're so crazy they don't want to find out.
Ah, I see. With your facial expression or body posture or whatever, the look in your eye.
The look in the eye. It's like, really? No, don't go there.
Mm.
Was, you know, a skill I was consciously taught by my father for riding the subway.
That's a great skill to have.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Especially riding the subway.
Well, the subways are safer than they were when I commuted to high school and college.
Mm.
New York City has changed in many ways, as have many, many other cities. But New York in many ways is so much safer than it was when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
So it's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting.
Well, so we just have a couple of minutes. I want to remind people that they can go to your site and donate to this project you have to print books and give them to kids who are being victimized by bullies all over the United States, which I think is just an incredible project, and thank you for doing that.
Oh, sure. It's usaprojects.org is the name of the site.
And, well, they can get there from your regular website, though, can't they? Is there a link?
I think so.
Okay,
I have, like, four websites, so I'm trying to go, flip through all the pages in my mind, you know, but if there isn't, I'll put one up. How's that?
Sounds good. And your website is?
Catherine-Mayfield.com.
It's Catherine with a K.
Yep.
And so what's next for you?
What's next? Well, that's a good question. I have a novel that I've been working on for about 10 years, and I love working on it, and it always gets pushed aside because for fiction, I just need a lot of space to write.
Right.
I'm working on an emotional abuse workbook. Sort of a format of exercises for people who have been emotionally abused. I'm writing a book on writing a memoir because I've done that, and I have two more memoirs in the pipeline. So my muse just doesn't shut up, you know, keeps telling me, do this, do that.
And in your spare time, right?
Right. In my copious spare time.
Right. Well, Catherine, thank you so much for being on the show again. As the saying goes, we really must do this again sometime.
Yes, that sounds good. Thank you so much for having me, David. I think you have a great show.
Thank you so much.
Even when I'm not on it.
That was good. My guest is Catherine Mayfield, author of the book Bullied, and we'll have her back because I'm sure she'll have another book any second now.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks, okay. Catherine.
Thank you, David. Take care.
And thank you, one and all, for being with us for another episode of the Farkas Files. If you want to find me and my work, you can go to househealing.com. And on the contact page, cleverly is hiding every conceivable way to get in touch with me, including a calendar to schedule a 20-minute free complimentary assessment of what's going on with you and how my work might be helpful. So get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. So until next week, and when we will have more fun, this is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Thanks for being with us. Have a great week.